Africa, I say, Jama, Jama. Mama Africa, I always pray, Jama, Jama.
You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We've got a great show for you today. We are going to take a look at a citizens' movement in Hudson, Quebec, to try and protect an area of forest right near Sandy Beach, if you've ever heard of it, along the Ottawa River. And we're also going to play a talk which happened in a course at Harvard University earlier last year that was all about nature therapy or forest bathing or the effects of nature on your health and well-being. A topic that we like to revisit here on Ecolibrium very much. So we're going to start with some music though, and this is the tune Bungle in the Jungle by Jethro Tull.
Walking through forests of palm tree apartments, scoff at the monkeys who live in their dark tents. Down by the water hole, drunk every Friday, eating their nuts, saving their raisins for Sunday. Lions and tigers who wait in the shadows, they're fast but they're lazy and sleep in green meadows. Well, that's bungle in the jungle. Well, that's all right by me, yes. Well, I'm a tiger when I want love, but I'm a snake if we did. Just say a word and the boys will be right there, with claws at your back to send the chill through the night. Hey, is it so frightening to have me at your shoulder? Thunder and lightning couldn't be bolder. I'll write on your tombstone, I thank you for dinner. This game that we animals play is the winner. Well, let's bungle. Snakes in the grass, he's a lover of life, but a player of pawns. Yes, the king on a sunset lies waiting for dawn to light up his jungle as players resume. The monkey see willing to strike up the tune. But let's bungle in the jungle.
And that was Bungle in the Jungle by Jethro Tull from the album War Child from 1974. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. So, just this past Sunday, I attended I didn't really attend the gathering. I got there sort of when it was already over, but I came to cover it for Ecolibrium, and it was an event called Protect Sandy Beach, and it was a citizens' gathering for the protection of the Sandy Beach woods in Hudson, Quebec. If you've ever been to Hudson, you may be familiar with Sandy Beach, which is right near a park, and it's sort of part of the park called Jack Layton Park. But there's a whole wetland there and forested area around there, and some very large, beautiful white pines on the shore of the Ottawa River, looking over towards Gunnasatage and Oka. And the majority of the land, not the beach itself, but the majority of the land, from my understanding, is owned by a developer, and there is a development project to build houses and condominiums and so on. So I spoke to two people when I was at the event to protect Sandy Beach, and so here are those interviews now. This is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with J.J. Corker, who is one of the founding members of Nature Hudson, and we're here today at Sandy Beach because there was just a protest today to basically ask the town of Hudson and whatever authorities to protect this beautiful natural area. And J.J., how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Thank you, Ryan.
So why did you come today?
Well, I came because I want to support the group that's working to save Sandy Beach. And I want to push the town council and town administration and the Minister of the Environment and everyone else who's authorizing this project to think about not developing here and protecting the amazing woodland, wetland, and beach that are here and that is known as Sandy Beach.
And so describe the site for someone who's never been here.
Well, the most amazing thing about the site, of course, are the eastern white pines, which tower above us and are just absolutely stunning. When you first come onto Sandy Beach, the presence of those pines is really felt immediately. Today, the wind is blowing through the leaves, and you hear that, and you get the smell of the pine as well. The ground is covered in red pine needles. There are two large sections of sand beach that line the lake. You can look across and see Kanesatake, where there's another mountainside of beautiful white pines. And if you continue to walk towards town from the beach area, you'll walk through a densely wooded area where the Vivry River snakes through. There's a few footbridges you can walk over. Sometimes you might see beavers trying to build a dam near one of the bridges. You'll definitely see snapping turtles in the river, amongst many, many other things.
Wow, sounds beautiful. You've lived in Hudson for how long?
I moved to Hudson when I was 6 years old and have lived off and on for about 40 years.
Okay. And what do you think is the most obvious solution to protect Sandy Beach? Or maybe there may be more than one possible solution, but
I see two solutions. One is a very simple solution where the town, with the help of CMM funds, purchases the entire development and saves Sandy Beach as is. The second solution would be to have the town, the developer, organizations like the CMM, perhaps conservation organizations, all sitting down at the table and figuring out a way to protect as much of Sandy Beach as possible, and perhaps to develop a small corner that's very close to the center of Hudson.
And this area, I think a lot of people sometimes already assume that it's public land.
Yes, they do. That's correct. It's not public land. It's been owned by the developer for over 20 years now and was owned by other people before that. The town has a servitude which goes from Jack Layton Park to the sand beach, which they will keep as part of the development. But the beach itself is owned by the developer, as are the paths going from Jack Layton Park to the beach.
And what is the wetland threatened?
The wetland is threatened. The Minister of the Environment has authorized the developer to fill in 1.58 hectares of wetland, which is over 4 acres, which is a significant amount. And then, of course, filling in that amount of wetland will no doubt have some impact on the neighboring wetland as well. In other words, the wetland that's adjacent to where they're backfilling. And so the wetland is, yes, it definitely is in danger. Yeah.
And when biologists have examined this area, do you know what they say?
I have not seen any biology reports from the developer. In other words, the biology reports that would have been part of the Article 22 application with the Ministry of the Environment. We've asked the ministry for that information, and it's very slow coming. The town paid for a conservation plan for the entire town last year. It was done by Eco2Herb, and Eco2Herb found that Sandy Beach was the most important ecological habitat in the town of Hudson. So, and they did a fair bit of groundwork in Sandy Beach and in the rest of town. And so we're assuming that there's a disconnect between what the ministry has seen from the developer and what we know to exist here from seeing it and also from the Eco2Herb report.
And you said you were part of Nature Hudson. What does Nature Hudson do and why was it formed?
Nature Hudson works to protect and conserve natural land in Hudson. Nature Hudson was founded when in 2018 we realized there were six separate parcels of land in Hudson that had been zoned high density development that all had important ecological wetlands, forests, and rivers on them. One of those, known as Como Bog, has already been developed. The second one, which is known as the Willowbrook Project, is currently being developed. It was just started this week. And two of the other plots of land are Sandy Beach. And then there are two others that are up for sale. So Nature Hudson, when we looked at the zoning in town and we looked at the areas where they had increased the density in 2017, we thought that it would be important to try and protect these areas.
My other question was, it's an election year, and what kind of pressure are you trying to put on elected officials or maybe candidates in the upcoming election about this issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the election may come into play in terms of Sandy Beach. We know the mayor is running again, and we don't know if any of the other current councillors are running. No one has put no candidates for council or mayor have put their hat in the ring yet. But I think that the election in November of this year is going to be very important, and hopefully the town of Hudson can put together a really strong group of people who are going to look at the natural areas in Hudson and work to protect them.
That's great. And what was the protest that happened here today? What, do you think it was successful? Do you think it was a good turnout?
I think it was really great. I think it was a great turnout. There are at least 200 people, maybe 250. It was a beautiful Sunday morning. Great atmosphere. Family, kids. And hopefully the current council and administration can accept the call from the citizens of Hudson to protect Sandy Beach.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ryan. Thank you for coming.
And that was my interview with J.J. Corker. I also spoke to Mark Gray.
This is Ryan Young with CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here with Mark Gray, who is a member of the Sandy Beach Wetland Protection Group. And we're here because there was a walk to raise awareness about protecting Sandy Beach. How are you doing today, Mark?
I'm doing great.
So why are you involved, Mark?
I have to say, I'm historically very keen on the environment. I'm a camper. The outdoors is certainly my thing. Last year, I came home from a trip. Family and I were away for a while, and I found that this project was going on when I thought it had been canceled after the floods. It's been on the books for 20 years in Hudson, and it didn't seem like anybody was talking about it. And I started asking around, and there seemed to be either an apathy about it, that there's no way we can stop it, it's just a fait accompli, or people were just completely unaware, especially after the floods. And our last election, we had voted in a council in its entirety on the fact that the previous council was seemed pro-development at all cost. So we pulled in this new council, they were all green, and with the floods we should be fine. And this type of development in a sensitive ecosystem like here at Sandy Beach would be a thing of the past and it would be protected. And that just wasn't the case. So I started asking around. Actually, it was a friend of mine who said, hey Mark, there's this group Nature Hudson that's looking into this. And then I started asking around and got involved, and then we started our Sandy Beach group, and we work in concert really with Nature Hudson to raise awareness at this point. It's our first step. So talking to the citizens and showing council that the citizens are on board and we want council to take part in protecting Sandy Beach.
Now, I've heard discussion of people collecting their own money to try and maybe buy the land. Is this true?
Yeah, I've had a lot of offers, people saying, can we give you money? And I'm amazed that people are willing to put their money into this so willingly. But our first step, there's a program with the Communauté Métropolitaine de Montréal called La Trame Verte et Bleue, and that got us going on looking into the purchasing options, because that certainly is the path of least resistance for a development like this. If we can convince the owner to just take our money and not do the development, that would be easiest for everybody. And with this Trame Verte et Bleue, the CMM has a bunch of money to go towards protecting green spaces like this. And they pay one third, the Quebec government pays a third, and the municipality is on the hook for the last third. Now, we don't really want the municipality to pay a third of a multi-million dollar cost likely for this type of project. So there's lots of other environmental groups that we're in talks with, you know, to supplement that money. And certainly when the time comes, these people who are willing to give their own personal finances up for a project like this, that's when we would be talking about that.
And have you lived in Hudson a long time?
Yeah, born and raised. Pretty proud to say we have about six generations of Grays in Hudson. So this is certainly home, that's for sure.
So you must have been coming here as a kid.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, now we hear complaints, you know, when the kids are partying on the beach with, you know, making bonfires and stuff. And, yeah, that was me when I was young, too.
And so... Are you happy with the turnout today? And then what do you think are the next steps?
I'm thrilled with the turnout today. I mean, in COVID times, even us as a group, you know, we've talked about this at length, whether we should even be doing this in the first place. The numbers are going up. We're into the third wave. At what point are we going to pull the plug on this get together? And I think if it was any later in the week, chances are we would have had to pull the plug. But it was a fantastic turnout. Everybody was wearing masks. Everybody was keeping their distance. There's a nice breeze today. It's outside. And so I'm absolutely thrilled with the turnout. And in terms of our awareness in the region, we're really hitting all the marks we're after. And that's because the population is supportive, you know. So I feel like we're clearly on the right track. The next steps are we got to get the councillors on board. We really need to do this as a group. That would make a huge difference. And then the other steps, of course, which are less favorable, are all the legal, you know, goings on behind the scenes, the infrastructure permit with the Environment Ministry, you know, the infrastructure agreement the town has, all those things are being scrutinized, you know, so, you know, we'll do what we need to do, that's for sure. But really, council on board, purchase the land, that's the best way forward, I think.
And when it comes to the provincial government, I have to say myself, I've always been disappointed by the Environment Ministry. Do you think it's bizarre that they would give the approval to develop land as sensitive as this?
They talk a great game. You know, I mean, you read the, you know, the laws and bylaws and, you know, they all say that, you know, all these spaces need to be protected, and yet everything gets approved, you know. So I thought we really want to go to the environment minister and say, hey, here's a great opportunity for you to not give this infrastructure permit and really put the kibosh on a plan like this. And when you look at this area, I mean, we're not the only municipality doing this. Every municipality in the region has a green space fight on their hands, and all for good reason, because there's fewer and fewer around. So if we don't protect this now, when are we going to do it? And my other favorite phrase is think globally, act locally. And boy, the environment minister is a citizen just like the rest of us. Hey, you can do something about it, so do something.
Absolutely. And this is an election year in Hudson, so I know you already talked a little bit about the local politics, but do you feel like going forward that you're just going to continue putting pressure, or do you have other events or other strategies in mind?
Well, certainly, you know, if our councillors don't get on board at this point, I mean, protecting green spaces and our environment in this climate crisis is job number one. I mean, it's the most important thing we can do for ourselves and for our kids. So that, in my mind, is number one. If they don't get on board, then clearly the election is going to be an important election, just like it was last time. You know, we tried it last time, but yes, most certainly we are talking about getting the right candidates in there. But it's not just getting a green candidate in there. It's also a green candidate that's going to put their money where their mouth is, but that is also, you know, educated in, you know, financial responsibility and running a town properly. There's a whole lot more to running for council than just protecting green spaces. You have to run a town, you know, fiscally responsibly as well. You know, it's the whole package. So yeah, we would definitely be working towards getting the right councillors in there, you know, that aren't tone deaf and are listening to their citizens and what they want and living within our means.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Mark.
Hey, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And that was my interview with Mark Gray from the Sandy Beach Wetland Protection Group. You can find the Sandy Beach Wetland Protection Group on Facebook, as well as Nature Hudson. Nature Hudson also has a website, which is naturehudson.org. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. Recently, Dr. John LaPuma did a guest lecture in a course at Harvard University on lifestyle medicine, and he was talking about basically the benefits of nature therapy and the phenomena of forest bathing and, you know, all the studies that have been done to show the beneficial effects that nature can have on our well-being and our health. And he is a best-selling author of books like Refuel and Chef MD, and he's also the founder of Plant with a Doc, a successful nature-based stress management and burnout reversal program for office workers. He is a medical doctor who is clinical director and founder of Chef Clinic, and he's also a professionally trained chef, organic and regenerative avocado farmer, and as I mentioned, an author. So he spoke as part of a guest lecture in this course at Harvard University in January of 2020, earlier last year. So take a listen.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. As Beth has alluded to, I'm keenly interested in how nature affects the body and how food affects the body. And I've been interested in these things for a while. I'm a board certified internist. I trained as a chef. And then not long ago, about 8 years ago, I bought an abandoned nursery and converted it into an organic farm here in California. And while that might sound like a crazy career path, it actually allows me to look at different ways that lifestyle medicine can work. And so I'm going to present to you today some of the scientific evidence for nature as medicine, which you might kind of already feel is good for you, just like some food is good for you and some you feel is bad for you. But unless you actually have some of the data to back that up, it just becomes kind of how you feel. So what I'm going to take you through is what some of that data looks like and where I think it's going and how you might be able to use nature yourself to feel better. So five parts today. about nature as medicine. First, we're going to define what nature is. Second, we're going to look at some of the scientific evidence and the different kinds of research studies for it. Third, we're going to look at the spectrum of therapies that are available in nature that have names and different factions in the field. Fourth, a prescription with Dr. Freitz and I collaborated on, and the idea that actually you might be able to prescribe nature for particular conditions and what that looks like. And then fifth, how you might be able to start this now. Now, it might be foreign to some of you that the nature can be prescribed, but doesn't have the side effects of drugs. So ask your doctor if nature is right for you. What does that mean? Well, here are some definitions of nature. By the way, that was done by a wonderful marketing firm in Colorado that decided that nature needed better PR. And they spoofed pharmaceutical ads and created a series of three. They're on YouTube. I suggest you go watch them. They're fun. And they really just did it as a pro bono project. So this is a World Health definition of nature. The elements and phenomena of Earth's lands and waters and elements are physical. A nature experience, though, is what we care about in medicine. We experience what we care about, how you interact with nature. And that's the whole natural world. And we interact with nature not so much by thinking about it, but through our senses, through how we taste and touch and smell and see and hear. I heard nature described as a relationship the other day, not a place. That when you're not outside or in touch with plants or animals or the elements, you still have a relationship. You still think about and can feel how nature makes you feel. So that's one set of definitions that we'll start with. The physical definition, by the way, was from the World Health Organization. What's nature deficit disorder? Richard Louv is a journalist who's still writing about this. His last book is called Our Relationship with Wild Animals, or Wilding. The Times reviewed it favorably just a couple weeks ago. He says that nature deficit disorder is a so little contact with nature that children especially have behavioral and social problems. I think that nature deficit disorder is also an adult problem, that as adults, sometimes we have so little contact with nature that not just our attention span goes away and that our ability to use our senses goes away, that we're more vulnerable to negative moods, but that we actually develop obesity and diabetes and attention disorders and depression and anxiety and other problems that actually nature, when substituted back in, as if it were a medication, actually helps to improve. And I'll show you some evidence for that. Nature therapy, I think of as the prescriptive, evidence-based use of natural settings. This is actually my set of definitions, that tries hard to look at how to prevent and treat symptoms and enhance well-being. Medicine's pretty good about trying to prevent and treat symptoms, trying to diagnose problems, trying to get at the core of problems and figure out what the smallest thing is that's wrong. But we're not very good at enhancing well-being, kind of using our native ability to heal and boosting it. Medicine doesn't really pay attention to that, even though the purpose of medicine is to enhance well-being. So nature actually, I think, has that as a way of being that can help us. Finally, it ought to be available to everybody. And in these discussions, often people who are in poverty, people of color are often left out because they actually have less access to the outside world than do people who are Caucasian and people of means, because it takes transportation costs and clothing costs. And of course, there's less greenery in urban neighborhoods, particularly concentrated urban neighborhoods, where some poor people live. And we'll talk about that disparity as well. Finally, climate change health problems. Climate change causes health problems, and they are actually addressed by nature therapy. What kinds of health problems come from climate change? Well, they're heat related, they're respiratory, their endocrine, including food insecurity, will have less food and of lower quality as the conditions worsen. Neuro and psychiatric and psychological problems like PTSD and depression and burnout and cardiovascular disease. There are some great projects going on to improve cardiovascular disease, but this is actually worsened by climate change as heat becomes more of a factor and inflammation becomes more of a factor as well. And we lose trees as well as our environment. Okay, so I'm going to talk now about some of the scientific evidence for how nature works. And it starts with this study in 1984, done by an architect, a landscape architect named Roger Ulrich, who was at the time working at Texas A&M. And he went to a hospital in Pennsylvania and looked at people who had had cholecystectomies or their gallbladders out. It used to be that you have to be in the hospital to have your gallbladder out for a week. In the 70s when he did this, in the middle and late 70s and early 80s. So what he did was to go back through the records and find people who had had cholecystectomies on this one ward who had a view of nature on the right and a view of a brick wall on the left. They'd had the same operation. They were age matched. Their populations were equal. And he found that those patients who had a view outside their window had a day less, 0.8 day less of a hospital stay, used fewer opioid medications, which were commonly prescribed for cholecystectomy then, used fewer pain medications overall, had better hospital experiences from their perspective and from the nurse's perspective. And this actually changed hospital architecture. Now, if you're in the hospital, you usually have a window, and there is an effort by landscape architects to make greenery present outside your window. So since 1984, there have been at least 1,000 peer-reviewed studies in the medical literature, although they're all scattered. And some are in the landscape literature, some in the horticulture literature, some in the animal care literature. But Howard Frumkin helped to bring many of them together in this 2017 piece, which is serving as a outline for the NIH to award grants to people who are potentially interested in doing research in this field. And Dr. Frumkin, who's at the time at the University of Washington, has actually just recently joined the Harvard Sea Change Board, the Climate Change Board, overseeing climate change activities for this institute that's powerful and interesting in at Harvard. And he discovered with his colleagues that there were a couple hundred studies that looked at the personal medical benefits of nature, and you see their birth outcomes, post-operative recovery, reduced obesity and diabetes, improved immune function, as well as some of the mental health benefits of nature. Less anxiety and depression, less ADHD and aggression, reduced stress. And this actually work has been updated by a woman named Daniel Shanahan in New Zealand just 6 months ago, who found not just a research agenda, but also a clinical one and expanded this work further. Almost all the studies I'm going to show you have been published in the last couple of years because the field is growing rapidly. They're really interested in some of the health benefits of forest bathing, which has been created in 1982 as a term and has been pioneered in Japan and in Korea, where there are tens of millions of dollars being devoted to health rangers and health parks and health forests, where people can go, often executives, but families as well, to actually be guided and feel specifically better from work and primarily work-related stress, depression, and anxiety. But this has been so interesting to people that the Japanese especially have studied forest bathing in more detail, which is really just being in the forest and using your senses for as little as 20 minutes, but in Japan up to 3 hours and sometimes longer, to kind of reconnect with nature, which turns out to have, as the video mentioned, immune effects. These forest therapy increased natural killer cells in these two studies by Lee and colleagues. Natural killer cells are the white blood cells in your body that you make naturally to attack attacking cells like cancer cells. And you want more of them because you want to destroy cells that are, in fact, not well-formed or not doing you any favors. And in this study, in men, natural killer cells, which admittedly very small, but still bears repeating, in men, forest therapy, just one session of it, improves your immunity for a month significantly, and in women for a week. At Harvard, forest bathing classes were offered last year, and they'll probably be offered this year. This is a study, a retrospective study that compared, it was a prospective study that compared the physiologic and psychological effects of forest bathing on people who could get depressed, and found that forest bathing actually reduces depressive tendencies. It's probably better for depression than it is for anxiety. This is a study that used virtual reality scenes of 7 different forests in Japan to determine which forest had the greatest effect on stress, but as measured by cortisol levels and amylase levels. And they found that actually running water as well as pools of water had the greatest effect in the forest on the viewer who, on the viewer's stress levels. Now, I'm going to switch gears and talk about some laboratory studies where houseplants are used to clean the air. Most of you have heard of air cleaning plants. And air cleaning plants are a real thing, but of course there are nuances. This guy on the Wolverton did the first studies for NASA. He identified 16 houseplants that were good at cleaning formaldehyde, benzene, and trichloroethylene from the air, inside air. And he used sealed chambers of air that had volatile organic compounds. And he found that these 16 plants were actually pretty good at that. And that's where the air cleaning plant industry really comes from. His studies have been repeated and extended, although many of those same studies are now thought to be not valid because we don't actually live in sealed chambers. We live in houses which are drafty, and some of the air in houses goes out and some comes in, and the volatile organic compounds that might be emitted from carpet or from paint or from other cleaners may not be really as concentrated as they are in an indoor chamber. So there's some controversy about this, but again, in our own work, we did a study giving people houseplants at work and sending them 12 texts over a month to teach them about being outside and stress control. And our pilot project subjects found that, in fact, it reduced stress and reversed burnout symptoms. And here's a guy with a Dracaena, which is a dragon plant that you see commonly in nurseries and can be used as a house plant or as an office plant. And there is a trend towards using greenery in offices and certainly at home as a way to beautify and to reduce stress. This next set of studies is about myopia or nearsightedness. And this is a journal from the American Academy of Ophthalmology just this month about myopia and how important it is. The subtitle is A Growing Pandemic, What to Do About Myopia. And it is a pandemic. In fact, in East Asia, about 90% of kids are nearsighted. And that's not so bad. You think, oh gosh, you know, you'll wear glasses or get eye drops. But in fact, about 15% of myopia turns into what's called high myopia, which causes cataracts and retinal detachment and glaucoma, which are much harder to treat and children shouldn't have, and adults really don't need to have them either. So this is a meta-analysis, which means a grouping of many different kinds of research studies that showed that being outside, planned outdoor time 40 to 80 minutes a day in these six different studies reduces nearsightedness from coming on, from getting it all together, by 50%. In fact, Taiwan has and has since 2010, has an initiative called Daily 120, where they suggest not up to 12 hours a week, but 2 hours a day for children, and increasingly now everyone, to be active outside. They started with just look at the horizon, but they have expanded it to all activities outside. And Singapore has a public health initiative also called Keep Myopia Away, Go Outdoors and Play. And they want kids, especially, you see the children pictured, to spend less time on computers and more time in the park and playing ball. And so here's an instance in which being outside is actually probably the treatment of choice to prevent an illness that causes real disability and unhappiness. Speaking of disability and unhappiness, this is a controlled study published in 2003, so it's an older study, of a procedure in the hospital called a bronchoscopy, which, as you know, I think, is looking in the lungs with a lighted flexible telescope to try to see what's wrong with the lungs, often to take a biopsy or to try to clear an infection. It's a very uncomfortable procedure that you need a sedative for. And so half the people in this study got a sedative. The other half looked at the babbling brook scene that was kind of life-size TV, that's at least a 55-inch TV. But they also heard babbling brook sounds. They played a tape of babbling brook sounds, again, 2003, before VR, before really big screen TVs, et cetera. And 30% of those people had very good or excellent pain control. Only 20% of the people who had got usual care, the sedative, had excellent or very good pain control. So here we see an intervention where pain control is the point, and nature seems to do better than standard care. Now, nature is not just the kind of representations of things, but it's also animals. If you have an animal, you have a relationship with the animal. We are animals. So we are in nature. You don't actually have to go out in nature. We're in nature already. But if you have an animal, you have a nice reminder of what nature is. And this is a study of 1,200 kids who, in the first 2 years of life, those kids who had a dog were traced over the next 10 years. And those kids who had a cat, same thing. And those kids who didn't have any animal, same thing. So those were the controls, the kids who didn't have anything. And then the kids with cats and dogs were the intervention, except that it was a retrospective look back. So this is looking back at kids who had animals or didn't from age zero on. Those kids who had an animal, specifically a dog, not a cat, the cat didn't work, actually had 25% less schizophrenia by the time they were 12. It didn't affect their bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder was the same. That's manic depressive illness. But for some reason, those children who had an animal, their parents had an animal, and they were around a kid, an animal, a dog, up until age two, developed less schizophrenia. Now, why would that be? What could that relationship be? Is this just an incidental finding? Does it have any meaning? Well, we know that returning veterans often suffer from PTSD, and that animal assisted therapy, like this bulldog on the right, is actually very helpful for PTSD for veterans. But could it actually affect children and psychiatric illness and mental development? Possibly. Here's a study of gardening, a vegetable gardening intervention. And of the blue zones in America, in the world, and there are five high longevity, high quality of life blue zones in America, worldwide, gardening seems to be the key activity along with walking that those subjects have in common. Vegetable gardening actually seems to improve physical activity and performance in breast cancer survivors, according to this study published in Cancer in 2018, as does protection of their telomeres. Breast cancer patients who have gardening weekly with master gardeners who are especially good at gardening and get special training for it have less fraying telomeres, which are the tips of chromosomes, which are protected and form a protective cap for the rest of the chromosome and actually fray away as you get older. But in breast cancer survivors who have weekly gardening lessons for 12 weeks with a master gardener, those telomeres actually seem to not fray quite as much, suggesting that they might have greater longevity, although that study hasn't yet been done. In nature therapy, there are lots of natural experiments, and I'm going to summarize a couple of them to show you what other kinds of studies are available. These people studied street tree density, how many trees are on a block, and what their canopies are like using satellite views in London. And they were able to use NHS data, which most people are members of in the UK. And they found that just one additional tree per street kilometer, in a kilometer is two-thirds of 0.62 of a mile. So one tree every 0.62 of a mile additional seemed to drop the number of antidepressant prescriptions by 2.5. In other words, the more greenery per block, the fewer antidepressants prescribed. This too, a retrospective study looking back, so there can have other variables involved. But it's suggestive anyway, that being around green areas improves mood, and in a demonstrable way that makes a medical difference. We already know that children in green neighborhoods have lower rates of obesity and less weight gain, that there's less air pollution in green neighborhoods, and air pollution, which rises with climate change, of course, is connected to more heart attacks and cancer and now autism and dementia. This study, which appeared in JAMA just in December last month, showed that kids who, and this was done with 60,000 Chinese children in a prospective way where they asked their parents over 6 months, how hyperactive is your kid, basically? How much problem do they have focusing? What are their symptoms that are behavioral of hyperactivity disorder without having diagnoses of ADHD? So that's a little weakness in the study. But having asked those parents of 60,000 children, how hyperactive is your child? They looked at and compared schools that had greenery within 1,000 meters of school or kindergarten, greenery within 500 meters and 100 meters. And then they looked at kids who went to school with greenery way outside of that 1,000 meters, none at all. And they found that the greener the area around the school, by again, those canopy density studies, which are increasingly done, the fewer ADHD symptoms kids had, and just a very small increase in greenness, which is a metric used in this research, made a difference in how much behavioral symptoms kids' parents reported. Now, this suggests that having more greenery around schools, actually just a little more greenery around schools, makes a big difference in behavior of kids, and ADHD in kids is a huge problem. Finally, I'm going to show you this interventional study that's being in part funded by the NIH, by the Nature Conservancy, and by private philanthropy in Louisville, which Aruni Bhatnagar, who's a cardiologist and a friend of mine there, is doing. He persuaded those three groups that he could plant 7,000 trees in a 20 square block part of Louisville that's very poor, that has really high incidences of obesity and diabetes, and especially cardiovascular disease, and find out whether the planting of these 7,000 trees over 5 years changes not just cortisol and blood pressure and pulse and high blood pressure, because we already know that that's likely, but also hospitalization, emergency department visit, prescription of medication, and visits to the cardiologist. So there is, and why might that work? Maybe because of air cleaning, maybe because of shade, maybe because of reduced heat effect, maybe because trees actually reduce inflammation around them, and of course, as you know, communicate with other trees. The leading hypotheses for this are the old friends hypothesis and the biophilia hypothesis. Attention restoration and changing your microbiome, which are the good bacteria in your skin and lungs and oral GI system and more, is also an important theory. The socialization and exercise are important theories and clearly have some beneficial influence for some people. Nature helps you recognize climate change. That also might be why you go outside, because then you're more mindful of your environment. The biophilia hypothesis that E.O. Wilson promoted in 1984 says we are inherently attracted to other living things, that as human beings, we like and are drawn towards plants and animals and the outside living things, and that this is something native to being human. That's one theory. The old friends hypothesis or hygiene hypothesis, which are related, is that separation from the bacteria and viruses and fungi and worms that we evolved with has been so great because of our crazy emphasis on overcleaning that we have dropped our immunity, that our immunity as species is not as powerful as it would have been, and that reawakening it with nature and nature therapy and contact with nature helps to improve it. So those are the key concepts. So what does this look like? It could look like ecotherapy, which is actually psychological and prescribed by psychotherapists. Green and blue care. I haven't mentioned a lot about water, but surf therapy, and I'm not talking about surfing online. Surf therapy is actually used for PTSD and rehabilitation for people who need it. Care farms are a big thing in the EU. There are about 800 of them, but virtually none in the United States, where people who are disabled and need to be go through rehab, go to a farm, an actual farm, and work with animals and vegetables and other people who need real rehabilitation. Often these people are disabled for 4 or 5 hours a day, and then have a small community that also helps them improve and re-enter in society. Animal-assisted therapy we've talked about. Bringing the outside in is a really important part of nature therapy. Josie Behedry in Santa Barbara is actually a leader in this, of greening the classroom, especially trying to make the inside resemble outside in some ways, to take some of the best parts of it. Forest bathing and therapeutic horticulture we've talked about. Exercising in nature, it's really different. And actually there are studies to show this as well, to exercise outside than it is inside in terms of your immunity, the body systems and how you respond physically. And there are probably other cues you get from nature that make it better for you physically than exercising indoors. Being able to look outside an actual window probably is helpful, but maybe not as helpful as actually being outside. There's a great study from Stanford showing MRIs of people who walked in a meadow versus people who walked down the street for 30 minutes, and then compare their prefrontal cortical activity where rumination lives. And those people who walked for 30 minutes in the meadow had demonstrably less rumination and less MRI activity in those centers that promote it. So exercising in nature is a key and easy thing to do, relatively speaking. Planting a garden is harder, particularly in January in Boston or almost anywhere. But if you go to Trader Joe's, they have rosemary plants for $2.50. Rosemary is impossible to kill. You can't kill it. Get a get coconut coir, which is the coconut bark. You could use peat moss, but it's endangered, so I wouldn't. Or half coconut coir and half potting soil, because potting soil doesn't usually drain well enough. But even rosemary will survive it. And put it in a pot and use it in soups and stews and casseroles and lasagna and stock. Use it to smell. Know that you have a living thing inside with in a 6-inch pot. That's all you need. And it will last to spring, and then you will be reminded that there are other gardens out there for you to explore. Eating higher quality and growing and buying local are probably the easiest way, not just to fight the climate change, but also to reconnect with nature. So it's the healthful ingredients in your salads. It's the being able to talk to people who actually grow the food that gives you a sense that you're not just bounded by plastic and cardboard and your food isn't either. Air cleaning plants for beauty and stress, interacting with an animal regularly. There are actually cat salons, which I didn't know of until about a year ago. If you don't have a dog or a cat, borrow one just to see what it's like. It reminds you of being connected to other things. And finally, the negative side is to stop using plastics and insecticides and cleaners and cosmetics that are putting toxins in the air around you or on your skin to begin with, that nature then has to clear. And the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org, has a very good list of cosmetics and cleaners that are actually good for you relative to others. Okay, so I'm happy to take any questions, and I hope it was fun.
And that was a guest lecture done by Dr. John LaPuma in a lifestyle medicine course at Harvard University last year, I believe in January of 2020. And if you want to find out more about John LaPuma or Dr. John LaPuma, you can go to his website, which is drjohnlapuma.com. So that's all the time we have left in the show today for Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So have a great rest of your day. And as usual, you can follow us on Facebook. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young. And you can also find our podcast, which is available at equilibrium.podbean.com. So thanks for listening. We're going to leave you with a song by Michel Rivard that talks about Montreal a lot. Michel Rivard, of course, who used to be in the famous Quebec band Beau Dommage. But this song is a much more recent creation. In fact, I think this song was released last year. And it's called Styromousse. So here is Styromousse by Michel Rivard.
Now more than ever, the simplest gestures are our best protection to fight the virus. That's why we need to continue following basic health measures, such as keeping a 2-meter distance from others, wearing a mask and washing our hands regularly. Avoid travel and non-essential trips. And if you develop symptoms, be sure to get tested promptly and follow self-isolation guidelines. See all of the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Tu regardes flotter les nuages dans ta tasse en styromousse. Ton café goûte le bâton, la vie est douce à Montréal. La chanteuse en fait des tonnes pour capter ton attention. Baisse le volume ou sors du char, la vie est courte, fais-toi pas mal. Le vieux port est inondé d'un gros soleil le bout du monde. Partirais-tu, aurais-tu le guts, qu'est-ce qui te retient à Montréal? Tu regardes valser les mouettes sur un ciel en papier bleu. Un beau portrait pour les touristes, qu'est-ce qu'on vient faire à Montréal? Ah, toi, c'est sûr, t'es venu pour elle, elle est tellement belle en uniforme. Ah, sans le savon, pis la famille, les rêves de filles à Ville-Laval.
mais toi et puis elle, c'est pas possible. Y'a comme une tâche qui revient tout le temps. Oublie le printemps, oublie la ville, la vue est plate. Change de canal. Tu regardes le pont à l'horizon, comment ça fait pour tenir tout seul? Ça prend du fer, pis des millions, pis toi t'as rien, fait que ferme ta gueule. Toi t'as rien sauf tout ton temps, pis tu te débrouilles avec tes mains. T'aimes le bois, t'aimes le silence, pis t'aimes...
Things not always recorded.